This podcast is sponsored by Runway, air traffic control for your mobile releases. Put your releases on autopilot. Runway will shepherd your release from kickoff to submission to release with no manual intervention. A single source of truth for your releases. Runway integrates with your favorite tools for a bird's eye view over release progress and blockers. Make your releases collaborative. Get a rich, contextualized release runbook that makes capturing responsibilities and tracking tasks crystal clear. Get more control on your releases on App Store and Play Store. Point your browser to runway.team. Thank you for sponsoring my podcast. I'm also revamping my newsletter. Check it out, appforce1.net to sign up. You can also find a sign-up link on my Twitter profile.
You are recording, right?
Yeah, I'm recording.
Yeah, check this. It's okay.
Oh, oops.
Oops. Yeah, let's press that button as well. And I'm sitting here with like the audio girl, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, so welcome to another special with Ellen Shapiro. Ellen and I, we go back a little bit, like 2 or 3 years maybe, when she was working in Amsterdam. And she was visiting the Cocoaheads NL meetups. So that's how Ellen and I got to know each other. But I definitely know that there's much more to her story. So we're going to dig into that. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Yeah, so you met me when I was living... I was actually living in Nijmegen, which is over by the German border. And I was working in Amsterdam for Bakken & Beck. They're a Norwegian company that has offices in Amsterdam and Bonn as well. So I was coming up to Amsterdam for all the Cocoaheads stuff, you know, lots of conferences and stuff. The Netherlands is not that big a place, so like I was going across the whole country to get to work, but that took like an hour and a half. I miss being there a lot. It was really a wonderful place to live, and my now wife and I got in a fellowship at a university in Nijmegen, and so we moved there, and yeah, it was really fun. And so, like, where did it all start? So I, in about 2010, I started learning how to program. I really, you know, I had done some like really, really, really basics, like literally basic stuff.
So basic, when you meant like Microsoft Basic, Visual Basic?
I actually don't really remember. Like I know I worked with Max. Like this is when I was a really little kid. Like there was like I was very lucky that I went to a school that had a computer lab. Even you know in the mid 80s when that was not very common. And I definitely remember like making little things show up on the screen, but like I kind of just drifted away from that. You know, I've always, particularly when I was younger, I was much more into music. So I actually, from when I was basically 10 till I was about probably 22, 23, I was really excited about songwriting and singing. So I even put out an album and stuff. You know, it's funny because I'm now almost 40 and like listening to stuff that I wrote between the ages of like 10 and 17, I'm like, oh God, I was very much a teenager, wasn't I? But, you know, I'm still proud of the music and stuff, but it really sort of, that direction took me away from technology that didn't involve audio for a long time. And, you know, I sort of joke that when I went to college, I was extremely lucky that my parents were able to help me pay for college. And by help me, I mean entirely pay for college. And, you know, it was sort of one of those things where it was like, all right, we're not going to pay for college for you if you go for music. What are you going to do instead? And I said, they said, we'll pay for anything except music. And I said, sweet, I'm going to film school. And they were like, oh, we should have been more specific. So I actually wound up mostly focusing on audio recording for films and stuff like that. And I was like, did a lot of sound stuff when I was in film school. And yeah, it was really fun. I kept doing music stuff on the side, and you know, I got to do a lot of messing around with different audio tool sets and like early versions of Pro Tools and like, you know, like working with really early versions of like Final Cut and stuff. And then, you know, one of the things I had a lot of fun doing was I built out for like another class, we did like a documentary because like everybody in my group was film people. So we were like, ooh, let's make a documentary because that's what happens when you put film people together. But yeah, it was really fun. And it's just like, I think I really like making stuff, and I think it was really, that creativity was really, really important to me. And then after that, I moved out to Los Angeles, because that was what you did when you got a film degree from a place in Chicago. There was like, I joked that there was like a caravan of like everybody in my graduating class moving out to LA. So I moved out to LA in 2003.
So basically, you did like basic in like when you were like a little girl, just fiddling with Macs that were available on the school that you were attending. And then your parents, they basically said, hey, Alan, we're going to pay you through college. And then you said like, yeah, let's go in some direction that they were like, oh boy.
Yeah. And yeah, it was sort of, it went from, you know, like the stuff that I was fiddling around with when I was a little kid. I remember playing with like HyperCard a little bit in high school, but like that's really kind of as far as that went. I did take one class that was like super basic HTML and CSS, and this was when like CSS was a new concept. So like people were just like, oh my God, you don't have to do everything in HTML. This is amazing. But like, yeah, it was definitely like very, very basic level stuff.
But if you then, so when you were really young, there was like some interest in something software development related, then you went into audio.
Not really. I mean, and that's the thing is like I was in that class because everybody took that class. Like it wasn't something where like when I was younger I was all that interested in it. And then, you know, when I was out in LA, when I'd moved out to LA to work, you know, I initially tried to get jobs working in audio production, but like timing was really messed up and there wasn't anything available. So I just took the first internship I could get, which was, I was an intern at the Ellen DeGeneres show, like 6 weeks after they went on the air. So that, and it's now been on the air for almost for 17 years now. I think they're on their like 18th season at this point. That was fun. And I wound up working my way like onto the bottom rung of the ladder there. And, you know, it was like, hey, I'm actually getting paid to do stuff. That's nice. I kind of went from step zero to step one there. I was always like the one person who knew how to hook up a Mac to like a networked printer. People would just come to me with tech questions, and I just got better and better and better at Googling the answers. It was fun. It was kind of fun to sort of have that as one of my like 17 half jobs. There was a point at which I was sort of like, okay, do I want to just like go into like IT where I'm just sort of dealing with, you know, setting up computers and stuff, or do I want to learn how to program? And I think for me, the biggest thing was that learning to program offered an opportunity to be creative again. One of the reasons that I liked working in TV was that like, oh, I have this thing where I'm like, I'm part of this big creative endeavor. But like the part that I was actually doing was mostly just like making sure that purchase orders were signed and making sure that like equipment showed up where it was supposed to be and like going to the writers and being like, hey guys, the network's asking for the script. Is that actually written or no? You know, and that part is less exciting from a creative standpoint. And I realized that to get to the part where I really had any creative influence, it was going to take several years of working for terrible people for terrible money. I kind of got to the point where I was like, why am I doing this to myself? You know, it's hard when you start something and you really enjoy it and you're really just having a good time. You're really like, even if there's stuff that's terrible, it's like, oh, that's not that bad because, you know, it's something where you're still learning a ton. And that's absolutely what like the beginning of my career in television was like. I was really excited, even though I was getting paid absolutely nothing. And, you know, it was, you know, I had to do all sorts of silly things because that's what you do on, you know, when you're a peon in Hollywood. And, you know, I still had a really good time with it. And then at a certain point, I realized that like that level of not having any kind of creative control over everything was really starting to bother me.
How do you then at some point decide like, well, hey, maybe I should just try coding?
Well, I mean, it mostly, like I said, I sort of joke that I'm a developer now because in 2003 I knew how to hook up a Mac to a networked printer.
Yeah, but that's IT, right?
It is, but I think it's something where it got me realizing that I had the skills to be able to work with some of this technical stuff that I think a lot of people are somewhat afraid of. And I think that, like, sort of building up that confidence to sort of basically be an unofficial IT person everywhere I worked. I was like, okay, I could be like an actual IT person, but I would rather do something creative. And that's, you know, and that's sort of where that stepping stone came from, because I think that, you know, that was really the process that I went through. It was like, sort of like, oh, I could be an IT person, but I want to make stuff. I guess I have to learn how to program. And, you know, this was also around when the first iPhones were coming out. So like the first iPhones came out in like 2007, and then the first SDK, I think, in 2008.
Yeah, that was iOS 3, I think, on the iPhone OS 3 that you could actually develop for. Before that, it was just something with JavaScript, I think.
Yeah, it was when they first released it, like people were really mad because there weren't any apps, but then people just started building apps anyway. Like Erica Sadoun wrote like entire books about like, here's how you jailbreak your phone and write apps, because screw it, I would rather do that. And so, yeah, she's been in that game for a long time. But then, so I went to a program at UCLA, which is the University of California, Los Angeles. They have this thing called the Extension Program, which is normally meant for people who are like working full-time jobs, and then they like do one or maybe two classes a week at night. I did not have a job, so I said, okay, I'm going to put this to 11, and I did what's normally a 2 to 3 year program in 6 months. So, you know, I learned, you know, I think where I really started was just like, here's what a for loop is. And, you know, I went through a, like an iPhone programming class, you know, and it was just really basic level stuff, you know, looking at a lot of stuff from like the Big Nerd Ranch guide and things like that. That's where I started to learn about some of the ways that you can sort of look stuff up. And that's like through that I wound up finding Ray Wenderlich's site, back when Ray was actually still writing all of the tutorials himself. And yeah, it was really fun. And I think I got to the point where I was like, okay, like I know that from sort of talking to people, I need to be able to like have something to show that shows that I can like do something halfway reasonable. And so I built an app for iOS and for Android. Because I've been doing both I had been doing both Android and iOS when I was doing that certificate program, and it was, you know, I've always found it interesting to sort of look at how sort of there's basically two different approaches to a very similar problem, in that like you have this, you know, little screen and you have not that much RAM and not that much processing power, or at least you didn't at that point, and you know, either not that much battery or the world's largest battery.
For some reason, you were also the person that was able to like hook up the Mac to the network, you said, and then you at some point decided, okay, I'm having a lot of fun, but I want to do something else, maybe something with IT. But then you like took the leap and thought, okay, I just want to be creative. I'm not going to do the IT stuff. I'm going to like leapfrog ahead to being a software developer. And then you basically did a half year course, which was basically to teach yourself programming. How did you actually transition from like knowing how and how, being able to write some code and to read some code, to actually being a true software developer, so that you would actually be confident enough to say like, hey man, you can hire me for something iPhone related, and I can develop it for you?
Yeah, I built to like a small application. You know, I was looking at like, okay, what's something that's like small that I can focus on that I know people need. So I built this app that I called Time Converter 24, where it basically takes, you know, what hour is it and how many minutes into that hour are we, and turns it into like decimal places. And the main reason I built it is because when I worked in TV production, people had to fill out time cards by saying, oh, okay, I didn't start at 5:30 p.m. I started at 17.5. And then we finished at, you know, 2:46 a.m. So that's, you know, because it's the next day, you have to add that to 24. And then I don't even remember what 46 is for tense off the top of my head. And it's something where like doing that at like 2:30 in the morning, especially if you just worked like a 16-hour day, is like really, really not simple. And so it's just something where it was small. I was able to just sort of say, okay, I did this. I managed to like integrate like an in-app purchase, and like I managed to like make a settings screen that doesn't look completely terrible. You know, it was something that really sort of allowed me to put everything together and also be able to publish something, because I think it's definitely still not super easy to publish things to the App Store, but it was a lot harder around iOS 4 when I first really started publishing things, or iOS, I guess 5 is when I really started publishing things. But yeah, it was a lot.
But was it a conscious effort to develop some portfolio apps that you could then get hired somewhere, or?
That was the idea. And like, it was nice because I got an email from someone who had been using the first app, and they said, hey, like, you know, who else uses this kind of time thing is Pilot. So then I took that and I made another app that was sort of being able to calculate takeoff and landing time for pilots, using that same kind of math. And so it was sort of something where I was like, okay, like I'm showing that I can like take code that I already wrote and repurpose it. I'm showing that, you know, I can take something and make it better. I'm showing, you know, I showed that I had marginally more design skills, you know, and it was definitely something where, you know, just sort of trying to build that out and show that I could do it was a big thing. And then, yeah, around that time, I started to get a couple of interviews, and the one place that I got a bite from was this place called The Nerdery, now just called Nerdery, because who needs articles? But the one of the things that I subsequently found out was that, like, I was one of the few people who had actually submitted something where, like, my own code, not only did it have all of, like, the warnings and errors fixed, which I was like, who doesn't just fix all the warnings and errors in your code? Are you nuts? But I had also fixed anything that was like an analysis, like the static analyzer warnings. And, you know, the guy who eventually sort of had to make the hire was like, yeah, like lots of people who are not nearly as experienced as you are just ignore that stuff because they think they don't need it. And, you know, I was like, the computer's telling you what you're doing wrong. Why are you not going to listen to it? you know, and I think, you know, to a certain extent that attitude still lives in my love for typed languages. Cause it's just like, yeah, computer says no, like you're trying to do this. You can't. But yeah, like that was something where I definitely got thrown into the deep end on my first job. Like, it was they were like, oh, here, just slice this Photoshop document and get out all of the assets. And I was just like, I've never done that before, and I don't have a copy of Photoshop. Would someone like to help me figure out how to do that? So it was really helpful that when I was at the Nerdery, they had a pretty big team. And so it meant that as a like super junior, I had a lot of support. And it was something where, you know, this was before code review was really terribly standard. like there were a couple of times where there would be a code review, like literally months after I wrote the code. It was like, okay, we got the idea. We just need the execution a little bit better.
But what is interesting, what you're saying is that up till your job at the Nerdery, you called it, you were basically sort of like swimming on your own, so to speak. You took some classes, you managed to put a couple of apps together, and then at the Nerdery, there were people around you that you could actually ask intelligent questions to and get a decent answer that would actually help you further.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing for people who are just starting out. You know, I think, you know, there are some people who really prefer to work alone or who really don't like working at agencies. But I will say, I don't think I would have gotten where I was as fast as I did if I wasn't like constantly working on new projects, which is what you wind up doing at agencies. You know, you get to hit that file new project much more often than you do for anything else. And then, like, sort of, you know, there's definitely some habits that can get you into that are not great in terms of maintainability. But it's also something where you get opportunities to try a lot of different stuff. And in my case, I think that really helped accelerate how much I was learning, because I just had to dive into all kinds of different stuff and just learn as much as I could, as fast as I could.
Okay, and the nerdery, what's it called nowadays? Nerdery, right?
Just called nerdery for the last couple of years, I guess. But yeah.
So, but how long did you work at this place?
So I worked there for 2 years.
And then what happened?
Yeah, so then I had gotten to be friends with some folks through the Chicago iOS community, a lot of whom worked at this company called Vokal, spelled V-O-K-A-L, because it is the internet. You can't spell anything correctly. You know, I wound up talking to them, and they made me an offer to come join them, and it was a very good offer, so I did. And, you know, that was really great, because working at Vokal was the first time that I had the experience of immediate feedback on code. So they were using, you know, GitHub and code reviews in a really integrated way, in a way that was not really happening when I was at the nerdery. Obviously it's been a few years since that was. I think they're almost certainly doing that now. But it's definitely something where, like, that immediate feedback loop was even more helpful, because I think there were things that I had just never really gotten any feedback about, because it was so far away from when something was originally written.
So Vokal was a agency like the nerdery?
It was another agency. So yeah, so I started out as an iOS developer, and then after about a year, I got promoted to senior, which was fun. Mm-hmm. That was nice. I was just like, my parents were just like, how are you a senior if you've only been doing this for 3 years? And I'm like, to be fair, this has only existed for like six. So it's definitely one of those things where, you know, there was a little bit of title chasing on my part, but, like, you know, it also is something where I've always been someone who's super into, like, mentoring and working with other people. And I think that is something that, like, I was able to take some of the skills that I gained when I worked in other industries and apply that to sort of the people side of working in technology.
So the being like a senior to your peers and trying to help them, is that something that comes natural to you, or is it something that you prefer to provide to your peers because that's something that you've got when you were junior?
A little bit of both. I mean, it definitely is something where I really try to pay things forward from, like, because I got a lot of help when I was starting out, and I think that really helped me get a lot better faster. But I think that, you know, one of the things that I've seen is that it's better for everyone when somebody who's new gets better faster. And I think that, like, you know, there comes a point where I sometimes see people who are just sort of like trying to hoard the knowledge and just be like, well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. And it's just like, you're not helping anyone by doing that. You're really just sort of tying your colleagues' hands behind their backs. And, you know, it's definitely something where, you know, there is a point at which, like, you want to be like, okay, try Googling it for like 15 minutes before you come and ask me any questions. Because that, you know, just like not putting any effort into finding it can be good. But then, like, if you can't find it after Googling for 15 minutes, then come ask a question, because you sitting there and banging your head against the wall is not going to be helpful for anybody.
But the hoarding of knowledge, that's something that I'd like to create, creating a liability. Because what I tend to do if I'm in a situation that somebody is creating a liability, it's like really go head to head with the liability. The liability needs to be gone. And there are multiple ways that you can deal with a liability like that. And one of the things is making sure that the knowledge is shared.
Well, and that's definitely harder to deal with when you're a newer programmer, because there's some people who are just like, well, that's just the way it is. And it's like, no, it's not. Maybe it's the way you are, and that means you're a jerk. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, some of it comes from, I think, for particularly for people who are in these sort of like very like cutthroat political situations, for in larger corporations, like this is something that I've seen over and over again, is that that is one of the biggest motivators for people to hoard knowledge, is just like, oh yeah, if I give knowledge to anyone else, then I won't get credit for it, and you know, things will be not good. And you know, like my wife is in academia, and like one of the biggest problems in academia is that like every bit of programming knowledge that everybody has is just like, okay, I've managed to hammer these two little things together in order to be able to make a reusable graph. You know, and like, how do I apply this to anything? And because the number of jobs are so small, you know, everybody is trying to get every advantage they possibly can over everybody else. And so people don't talk about like, hey, let's all work together to make an easier way to do this. Like it's something where, you know, that incentive is to keep as much of that knowledge close to your chest as you possibly can.
So, but you're actually from Wisconsin, if I'm correct?
So I live in Wisconsin. I am originally from Washington, D.C. So I was born and raised in D.C. I lived there until I was 18. And then lived in L.A. for 8 years. Well, not then. I went to college in Chicago for 4 years, lived in L.A. for 8 years, then moved back to Chicago for another 6 years. And that's when I moved to the Netherlands for 2 years. And then about a year ago, we moved here to Wisconsin, which is where my wife has another fellowship. So, yeah, it's been interesting. You know, I'm very, very lucky because, you know, this is very much in contrast to when I worked in television production. You know, when I worked in TV production, your options were live in LA or don't have a job. You know, with what I do now, basically all I need is a laptop and internet connection to get my job done. So the fact that I live in Madison, Wisconsin, rather than in, you know, one of the major tech hubs, in New York or San Francisco, or even in Chicago is not really, that big of a deterrent to potential employers, because, you know, the place I work now is all remote. They were like 70% remote, I think, before the pandemic, and obviously right now we're all remote. But yeah, like they were very. But you know, that's been really good because, like, you know, having the flexibility where we're, you know, if we move somewhere, we're not looking for two jobs, is really helpful. And you know, it's definitely made my wife's life easier in terms of trying to find jobs. So
yeah, you're saying your wife, because she got married recently, right?
Yeah, so we were supposed to have a big wedding on June 14th. We did get married on June 14th. It was a wedding that included me, her, and our rabbi, and that was it.
Just a tad bit smaller than what you were planning.
Slightly smaller. Yeah, we're still actually planning on having like a wedding. So we rescheduled it for August of 2021.
Fingers crossed.
Oh, man, I'm going to be out a lot of money if that doesn't work. And B, I'm going to be really disappointed because, like, honestly, like I'm ready to just like actually hang out with people and party. Because, yeah, I'm a huge extrovert, and being home alone all the time kind of sucks.
I didn't notice that when you were in Amsterdam.
I know. I never kept talking to people for hours at a time, even though I probably should go and catch the last train. Yeah, it's definitely something where, you know, like when I was living in Nijmegen, I didn't come to Amsterdam 5 days a week because that would have been insane. Like 15 hours a week on the train is kind of bonkers. But I came 3 days a week because I really, really prefer being in a place with people. And, you know, before the pandemic hit, I had just gotten a co-working space. And I was really like getting it and like really getting to be like actually getting to hang out with people. And I was like, oh, okay, I like this. And then it's like, and now you're working from home.
Nope.
Yeah. So like, yeah, there was a very long period of time where I was just like, well, this is just going to be, it's going to be fine. I don't really have enough room to like have a second desk here. So like, I'm just going to like sit on this like sort of couch chair and put a dining room table leaf across it and use that as my desk. And it's just basically like, yeah, that's not actually good for your back.
Seriously.
Yeah, I know. It turns out. Like literally last week, I just finally was like, I can't take this anymore. And I had to find like a really, really small desk because like, I think you can see, I obviously your listeners can't, that I am currently in my bedroom. Like,
with the cat.
Yeah. Yep. George Michael snoring away in the background. I don't know if you can hear that.
He's like leaving us to it, I must say, because I've seen other videos of you that he's like in your face all the time.
Yeah, he's just excited that it's like it's the middle of the day and he can just kind of sleep all the time. but yeah, like, yeah, so we have two cats who've been keeping us entertained, but it's definitely something where like I've been having a difficult time with being home all the time and not really getting to see people because that's, you know, I'm used to, you know, I've told a couple of people, like, I'm used to being at a different conference every month. I've been doing that probably since about 2016.
Yeah, you were getting around a lot.
Yeah.
I noticed that on your schedule, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's definitely something where I really enjoy speaking at conferences. I really have a good time doing it. And I also love to travel. So, like, when people are like, would you like to come to Italy? We'll pay you to come. I was like, yes, I would.
Yep.
I'm like, yes, please, yeah. Please save me a giant ball of burrata. But, you know, it's definitely something where it, you know, I've done a couple of remote conferences, and I think it is a little bit harder just because I really do feed off of the energy of the people in the room.
Can I tell you a little secret?
Yeah,
and that's fine if it's recorded. But the reason I started my podcast talking to a screen, like, it really freaked me out, and then I was like, okay, if it hurts, do it more often, right?
Yeah, I don't know about that one. That does sound like the Dutch approach, but yeah, I think for me it's definitely something where I definitely do better in one-on-one talks with people. It is really weird to sort of just be giving a talk where you're like, here's the punchline, and it's like, I have no idea if anybody laughed at that. And, you know, I think it is something where there's pieces of doing remote conferences that are easier just in terms of, like, you don't actually have to get on a plane and go anywhere. You know, you don't even have to put on pants. But, like, you know, it's something where, you know, I think that one of the things that's good about it is that you're able to sort of stop and do other stuff if you need to, but it also means that, like, you have less of the incentive to, like, actually listen to a talk. Yeah, and, like, you know, especially when things are happening, like, during work time, that can be very difficult. I think it's also something where, like, one of the things that I've found when I'm at conferences is that I actually close my laptop and, like, take notes with a Apple Pencil on an iPad because, like, I have horrible ADD, and that's just sort of, like, the way that my brain, like, if I leave my laptop open, I'm going to be working on something, and I'm going to get distracted, I'm going to miss something that's useful. And if I'm just sitting there, like, actually taking notes, or, you know, even if I'm just, like, I think people have probably seen me, like, sitting in the back, like, drawing all sorts of stuff on my iPad, but, like, I need to not be looking at my computer, because otherwise I get way too easily distracted. And when I was in high school, I had, like, this graph paper that I would draw, like, patterns and stuff all over while I was listening to class. And I found that recently, and it's, like, this thick of old graph paper that I just did all sorts of patterns on. And I was like, wow, it's, what a surprise that I was later diagnosed with ADD. You know, and it's something where I think for me, like, having something to, like, shut up the part of my brain that's like, la, 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 like, is really important.
Yeah, because the doodling that you're doing with your pencil is then really, like, it's just enough to keep mm-hmm. that part of your brain occupied so that the other part of your brain can actually focus on what you want to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a very interesting effect. I've seen it before, and very occasionally I do that as well. Yeah. But
And it's definitely something that, like, personally works for me. It does not work for everybody, because I definitely know people who are just like, ooh, now I'm going to concentrate on the art. And it's like, nope. So it's definitely, you know, it's definitely something where...
Are you one of those people that if they go to a museum with artworks that you start wondering about what colors they've chosen for the wallpaper next to the artwork?
No, I'm not quite that. I'm not quite at that level, but okay. Yeah. Well, and usually depending on the museum, you know, obviously if it's like part of a permanent collection or something, there's probably some kind of rhyme or reason to what's going on there. But, you know, if it's not like a permanent collection, it's just like, well, this was blue.
Colors.
So, I guess we'll put the blue painting on this wall. Sounds like a plan.
So, besides your day job at GraphQL,
yeah, Apollo.
Are there other things that you currently undertake? Well, not much you can do right now, like out of the house. But are there other activities that you do, sort of like somewhat professionally or?
Not terribly professionally. You know, obviously I've been doing a lot of editing. I used to do more writing, but now a lot of editing for books for Ray Wenderlich. And then non-professionally, we bought a kayak because we live a block from a lake. And we were like, all right, you know, it's a good way to socially distance from people is to paddle out into the middle of the lake. And yeah, that was really fun. We wound up going all over Wisconsin and, you know, going to lakes and rivers and stuff. And it was really fun. And you know, my wife and I are both very like outdoorsy. So
you say outdoorsy, but is that like, day trips or, also camping?
For us, it's been more day trips. It used to be more camping, but, there's a number of reasons that's less common right now. Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get back to doing more camping, in the future. I don't know. It's been, you know, I think it's definitely been nice, you know, just sort of being forced to spend more time outdoors. 'Cause it's like, do you want to see literally anyone? Good. Go outside.
Yeah, because then it's easy to like talk to someone and keep enough distance.
Yeah, so we bought a fire pit, so we can just like, you know, put some logs in the fire pit and still talk to people because it's kind of cold over here right now. And you know, it's been nice to be able to spend time with some people, just because like, yeah, like being able to do it and still be safe is like kind of critical. So it's. Yeah, it's really, and you know, obviously right now things in the U.S. are not good, like really not good. And so it is something where I think everybody is really trying to be extra careful, or at least the people that I know are trying to be extra careful. There's certainly a number of people who clearly are not, but, you know, trying to balance sort of that psychological need for human contact and the desire to not get this virus is difficult. And, you know, I think it is something where, you know, I knew several people who got it when the first round of stuff went through. Somebody that I know who was older passed away from it. One of my coworkers actually wound up with basically the long COVID stuff, where it's like, congratulations, you now feel like crap forever. And it seems pretty awful. And it's something where, you know, I have asthma, I am overweight. Those are both risk factors. And so I'm just really trying not to get sick. Which, you know, it's definitely something where you have to put a lot of effort into it. And, there's a lot of people who are really, really tired of putting a lot of effort into it. And I think you've sort of seen that happen in the numbers in the US where people are just, there's some people that are basically giving up on it, and it's really frustrating because of a lot
of
reasons.
Do you do? Yeah. You worked at Focal for how long?
So I was there for almost 4 years. So after I got promoted to a senior, I was a senior there for 2.5 years. And then my director quit and I became the director of iOS development, which was not a good idea for anyone involved. It turns out that when you put someone in charge of like 25 people and you put them in charge of a huge project, that is a recipe for burnout. And there was a lot of stuff going on at that job at that time. Things didn't go very well. And I definitely burned out super hard. And eventually there were some things that happened and I wound up just leaving.
It was a severe case of the Peter principle, I reckon.
I don't think it was the Peter principle in terms of like you're going to be promoted until you fail. I think some of it was I didn't know what I was getting myself into when I was like, oh, okay, cool. Now I have an even better title. And then like there's all of this stuff that you when you're at that level that you need to know and care about that I just was like completely shielded from by my predecessor. And then when I was no longer shielded from it, I was like, oh my God, this is horrible.
You got promoted and it didn't really work out, so you went somewhere else.
Yeah, well, at first I just quit. Because I was just like, things got to a point where I knew that I was not going to be able to provide the leadership that was needed. I was like, I cannot do this. I am not in a position to say, yes, I agree that everything that we're doing here is what needs to be done.
But was it more like a hard lesson or like a confirmation to yourself, okay, this is not something I want to do?
A little bit of both. You know, it was definitely, I think for me, it was a hard lesson because I think I didn't really put as much thought into what it would mean to take that job as I absolutely should have. You know, I was just like, sweet, I got another promotion. And I didn't really understand what that meant in terms of how that job would change, and particularly in terms of how much less time I would spend working on code.
What advice would you give to your younger self, like the day before this offer was extended to you?
Agree to take it on an interim basis so it's easier to step back if you don't like it. You know, it was definitely something where there's a lot of advice I'd give about that particular company, but it's definitely something where, you know, a lot of the stuff that wound up happening there wasn't really anybody's fault. There was just a lot of really bad luck happened all at once. And it led to some really nasty fallout.
Of course, this case is specific to you, but I think it's a principle that a lot of software developers get to face at some point in their career, because everybody starts as a junior, starts programming, gets senior, rolls into a lead engineer position, maybe a principal engineer position, still very technical. And then at some point, the only way up, it seems, is to go into some form of management.
There's a lot of companies that are working on sort of how do we have an advanced engineering track that means that people are sort of like still able to progress their careers without having to become managers. And I think that's certainly a thing that people are keeping an eye on. But yeah, there is a lot of places where people sort of have to make a choice between being a manager and being an individual contributor. And I think a lot of people don't really realize how their life is going to change when they make that choice, or if they try to keep doing both, which is what I tried to do. Congratulations, you now have two jobs. And that is exhausting. And you know, that's definitely something where, you know, I think I would probably also tell myself, like, you're gonna either be this management-y person or you're gonna build stuff. Like, pick one.
There's actually a book that I read on this specific topic by O'Reilly. Maybe you've heard of it. It's by Camille Fournier, and it's The Manager's Path. And it's a very concise guide on like well, just different levels of what they call leadership. If you are in a software development engineering role, so
yeah,
if people are facing the same issues that you described here, then maybe that's a good resource for people to actually have a look at.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more resources around it, and like I do feel like there were some resources around it at the time that I just like didn't even like know existed, and I think for me the biggest thing was just like I was so sort of like focused on being proud that I got asked to do this that I wasn't really paying attention to whether that was a good idea or not.
Yeah, that's a big trap. That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, so you fell in that trap.
Oh yeah.
Then you escaped it.
Yep. I managed to like prop open the bear trap with a stick and like pull my leg back out, and yeah, that's so I quit.
And then what happened? What did you do then next?
I took a little bit of time off, not a ton, but then I wound up taking a position at a company called Spot Hero. So they had initially built out their iOS and Android applications with a contractor. And what Spot Hero does is they do like short-term rentals of parking spots in the US and Canada. So, you know, if let's say it's not COVID and you were going to go to a play and you live out in the suburbs, you could pay for your parking space and get a little like QR code that you get to the thing and you show them the QR code and then they just let you go in and park. So you don't have to worry about looking around for a parking space. You don't have to worry about, you know, like trying to circle the block 800 times. You just go and you're done. And, you know, that was... I think one of the things that I was looking at in terms of like what kind of job I wanted after Vocal, you know, one of the things that had always been hard was stuff where as an agency, we would build a bunch of stuff and we spend all of this time and all of this effort building stuff. And it would either like be out in the world for like 3 months and then fall apart, or, you know, or it would literally just be made to throw away. And I was just like, you know, I want to make sure that I land someplace where I can explain what it is the company that I work for does to my parents. And like Spot Hero was like right in that sweet spot where I can say, hey, this is the thing that you can actually use. And they were like, cool. And, you know, it was something where, because there were definitely a lot of things where it was like, oh, there's these like esoteric, these really interesting things that are happening, but like it wasn't clear where money was coming from. It wasn't clear what kind of business plan anything had. And like Spot Hero, it was like they had sort of a product market fit. They just needed to make their product better and more stable. And so, yeah, so they brought me in and I built out the team there. So eventually when I left to move to the Netherlands, we had... I think 5 iOS developers and 4 Android developers. I think both of those numbers, including me. But you know, it was really fun because we were able to really I was able to bring in some really really good developers, and we were able to build some neat stuff. And we were really able to set that app up for long term success. And it was a little bit disappointing that I couldn't keep working for them when I moved to the Netherlands, just for assorted legal and tax reasons, because we had sort of finally gotten to that point of like, all right, we've got it like out of the mud and we've got it to a point where like it's going to be easier to build on long term. Now let's go. And then it was like, and I gotta go. Bye. Love you guys.
But, oh, that's you did leave on a high note there then, and that's probably one of the places that you worked that you have fond memories of.
For the most part, yeah. Yeah, no, I liked working there. And yeah, I felt really bad. Like they've really gotten hammered by COVID, just because obviously if people don't leave their house, they don't need to park their car anywhere. So that's been really hard for a lot of the people that I used to work with there. And that's been difficult for a lot of places. I think it is something where like, I think one thing that's really hard for a lot of these businesses is their long-term business plans are perfectly sound, assuming that there's not a once in a century pandemic. And like, if there is a once in a century pandemic, there might be
problems. And then
it's over. Yeah. And it's just like, you know, it's really hard because people have to make decisions to try and get their, to try and get their team through it in whatever form they can. But, you know, it's hard, man. It's really hard.
So then your now wife asked you to move to the Netherlands?
It was like, do you want to move to the Netherlands? I was like, yes. She was like, I haven't told you where or when. And I was like, yes.
When you went there, you already had a job, or you started looking when you were situated in the Netherlands?
Already? Yeah, I started looking when we got to Nijmegen. I actually, that was part of why I started coming to Coho Heads in Amsterdam, was to start meeting people and start sort of trying to understand sort of, you know, how much of this is possible if I continue to work from Nijmegen, or, and how much of, like, what's possible if I wind up moving to, or if I wind up just commuting to Amsterdam. And so it was definitely interesting. I spoke to a few different people, and I got a few interviews from talking to people there. And yeah, like, it was really helpful for me to be able to, like, sort of meet everyone. It's also...
So what year was that actually that you
2017
landed? 2017.
Yeah. And it's definitely, you know, like, in terms of, like, moving overseas for Americans, like, the Netherlands is kind of easy mode, because especially in Amsterdam, like, the Dutch Coho Heads is all in English. Like, there's definitely, you know, als je wilt Nederlands spreek, you can. But, you know, if you want to speak Dutch, you can. But all of the presentations are in English. Most Dutch people, particularly in Amsterdam, speak very, very, very good English. And, you know, I wound up learning a fair amount of Dutch, partly to make it easier for me to communicate in Nijmegen, where there's at least moderately fewer people who have essentially perfect English. But, you know, it's definitely something where, in terms of, like, oh yeah, like, I didn't, like, move to, like, you know, like, Warsaw or something and find something where it's like, oh, this is all in Polish, which I don't speak, you know. And it's definitely something where, you know, being able to have that community when we moved was really, really helpful. And it's definitely something that, you know, I'm looking forward to wherever we move next. You know, Lord only knows where that's going to be. But, you know, I think having the iOS community and having this community that you can reach out to across the world is really, really helpful.
Yeah, I think if you have a good network, then especially nowadays, that if you know the right people, then it doesn't matter where you go, there's always somebody that, based on your merits, that can say, like, hey man, I got a job for you if you need it. And maybe it doesn't pay the best money, but still, you there is some income.
Gotta start somewhere. Yeah, and I think...
And imagine if you move to, like, Alaska or something, how much money could you need? Like, not a lot.
Alaska's actually surprisingly expensive, because it takes, like, you gotta, like, schlep stuff up there to get it there.
Yeah, that's true.
It's kind of like being in Norway, where it's just like, oh yeah, like, we're, like, way up here. And also, everything is really expensive.
Well, you don't have to, like, pay a lot of money for keeping stuff frozen, but that's another.
Yeah, that helps. Yeah, no, that's.
So, but so then you wound up at Beckenbach.
Yep.
I think I pronounced it correctly.
Yeah, it's Bakken and Beck.
Oh, Bakken and Beck. Sorry. Yeah. and you worked there for a few years.
Yeah, I worked there for about a year and a half. So we were in the Netherlands for a total of 2 years. And sort of when it became fairly clear that we were going to be going back to the U.S., but it wasn't super clear where in the U.S. that we were going to be going, I started keeping an ear to the ground for remote jobs. And then I saw the position at Apollo listed, and I'd already been interested in GraphQL. I'd already been sort of starting to look into it from a technology standpoint. And I could tell that they were sort of in a position somewhat similar to Spot Hero when I started there, where they were like, hey, we made some mobile things, help. And
so, like, hey, we built something and it's cool, but I don't know, stuff keeps falling off. Can you help us, please?
Yeah. And I'm like, well, you've come to the right place. And yeah, it's really exciting. I think long term, I really want to try to build out a really strong mobile practice there and try to get, like, mobile specific developer relations kicked off there. But that's definitely first thing I have to do is get the iOS SDK to 1.0, which will be hopefully soon-ish, maybe. You know, I think one of the things that was difficult about starting when I did was that there was a lot of bit rot, and there was a lot of stuff that just hadn't been touched in like 2 or 3 years, and it wasn't like actively bad or anything. It was just very difficult to understand. And so I've been, you know, working through a lot of changes on that. And then I'm very, very glad the person who actually originally wrote the SDK is actually back with Apollo and helping me untangle the cache, which is complicated. Yeah, like I'm really hoping that between the two of us, we're going to be able to get the iOS SDK to something where we're really comfortable calling it a 1.0 and saying, all right, we're going to really like work to improve it from here and get it to a point where like we're really excited about what this can do. And
so what made you like apply at Apollo?
You know, I first applied there partly because I knew that they were looking for someone who had both iOS and Android experience, which I do. I knew that obviously I was excited about GraphQL. Like I was like, if I'm not excited about GraphQL, this seems like a dumb job. You know, I think it was also just the ability to work from anywhere. You know, the fact that I knew that I was going to have something flexible because we didn't know where we were going to be moving. Like that was a big deal for me.
Is it a comforting idea that no matter what your partner in life decides to do next, that you can say like, hey, you're going there, I'm going with you, and no problems with my job. Maybe some time zone difference, but hey.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, you know, it really is meaningful to me where like, you know, my wife, like I said, she's an academic, so she needs like a lab and a research board and, you know, a university to work at and all sorts of things like that, that require her presence in a physical place in a way that my work really doesn't. And, you know, it is something where having the flexibility to be able to, you know, let her take whatever seems like the best opportunity rather than whatever seems like the best opportunity where I can also get a job is like, that's a game changer. You know, I think, you know, she's seen this a lot with a lot of people who have, you know, both members of the couple are in academia, so they call it the two-body problem, and where they not only have to find a place that will hire one of them, they have to find a place that will hire both of them. And that's not always very simple. So it's definitely something where, you know, not having the two-body problem is a huge help for her. And I think for me, like, just being able to be that much more of a supportive partner is important to me.
So, but how did an audio technician like you and a academia, how did the two of you meet actually?
Okay, Cupid.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, internet.
Gotta love it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, she was at the University of Chicago, and when I was working in Chicago, and yeah, so got internet blind date basically. So
how long ago was this?
This was 2014, I think. Yeah, because it was I measure thing in polar vortexes. It was after the polar vortex in winter of 2013-14, where that was a terrible winter.
It was a cold one.
Yes, it was like so. You know how Fahrenheit and Celsius come back together around -40.
Yeah. Also, it was 0 on both scales or something, or what was it again?
So -40 for both Fahrenheit and Celsius.
They intersect at one point, and that's like really cold.
Yes. That's how cold it was.
That's like your fingers are going to fall off cold.
Yeah. It was like you do not want to have any exposed skin cold. Like I have a picture of me where I'm wearing like a big like mask and I'm wearing ski goggles and a big hat. And it's just like not a millimeter of skin is exposed, because if it was, I would have gotten frostbite.
Yeah, it would have been painful. Yeah. Okay. So you now work at GraphQL.
Apollo GraphQL. So Apollo is like the...
Yeah, sorry, Apollo GraphQL.
Yeah. Apollo is the company that, like, yeah, Apollo is a slightly overloaded name. There's like multiple different companies all called Apollo, and we sometimes get confused with them. We're like, no, we're not the terrible hedge fund that like messes up everything.
The plan is to go to the moon, though.
Yeah, we're going for the moon. Yeah, we definitely have like obviously lots and lots of space jokes and space references. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's so yeah. So I've worked there about a year and a half now, and yeah, it's been really nice, and it's been really rewarding to hear back from people who are really excited about sort of the changes and getting stuff to a more stable position. And you know, I'm slightly disappointed in myself that I haven't been able to get as much of the sort of final piece of things done. It is something where I think I am coming to a realization of how much work I've gotten myself into. And so it's been something that I'm really trying to move forward as fast as I can. I just wish as fast as I can was faster than it is.
Okay, well, there was one piece of advice that you already gave. That was like, if you're like happily, merrily developing software, and then at some point somebody proposes a promotion to like a sort of managerial type of role, step back, think about it, know what you get yourself into. That's basically what you're saying. Are there any other pieces of advice that you would give any random developer out there?
Yeah, I think one thing I often say to people who are just getting started is, one of the things that I had a really hard time with, because I was like a overachiever when I was in school, you know, I was always like, oh, give me an A, must have A, like, you know, I was very much that jerk. But it was something where when I first started working on apps and code, when something wouldn't compile or something didn't work the first time, I would get really angry at myself.
You mean nerd rage?
It's nerd like self-flagellation. You know, one of the keys for me that allowed me to sort of basically continue programming and not lose my absolute mind was being able to step back and sort of take a look at when something fails as this is trying to tell me something. Let me try to figure out what this failure is trying to tell me. And, you know, if it fails with an error, well, that makes that there's what it's trying to tell you. But, you know, if it fails and you're like, I don't know why this isn't working, then it sort of turns more into like a detective novel of like, who killed my code? Oh, wait, I did. But, you know, it's definitely something where having the attitude of a failure to build is not a failure of self. It's something where it is a step along the way to getting something to work. That was huge for me because I think that stopped me from beating myself up as much as I had been. And I think if I had kept beating myself up like that, I never would have kept coding. Like, I just wouldn't have been possible.
Okay. And any books or resources that you would recommend?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I have to give the obviously biased answer of you should totally subscribe to the Ray Wunderlich Total Book package. So
I should get an affiliate link from this guy.
Yeah, you totally should. I've been an editor on a bunch of books, and they recently changed some of their business models so that you can actually access all of the books through a subscription model. And like, it's a slightly lower fee for like sort of beginner level books only. And then it's a slightly higher fee for like every single book that they've ever put out. I'm in the middle of reading a book. It's called Working in Public. And it's a book about open source stewardship. And it's a book about sort of what is open source and sort of how do different people define what open source is. It's by Stripe Press, which apparently the guys who created Stripe made enough money that they were like, let's make a vanity press. But yeah, this is one of the few books that I've bought in like dead tree format in a while because it's actually a really cool looking book.
Okay, that's a good one to add to the list. Is there something that we missed or something you'd like to add or...
If anyone is interested in learning more about Apollo, apollographql.com. Yeah, if you go to docs/iOS, there's both a tutorial and some installation and API reference stuff that should really be helpful for people who are just getting started with it. I also did a talk fairly recently that's called GraphQL from the Ground Up. because my original title, WTF is GraphQL, got rejected. Yeah, I really enjoyed putting that one together because I think I tried to explain a lot of the basics of GraphQL that I think are often explained from a front-end standpoint, and I don't think they're often explained from a mobile standpoint. So I tried to explain them from sort of how we think about interacting with APIs for mobile and sort of some of the differences between what you're getting for REST versus GraphQL. REST makes a lot more sense for some things, but I think it's also something where it is possible to have to look at what you have and say, okay, how can we best take advantage of GraphQL where it helps us, and then not try to take advantage of GraphQL where that would not be helpful. So,
okay, well, I think that's some interesting topics to look into. I do want to wrap it up because we've been going at it for quite a long time. So, thank you, Alan. It was very interesting to hear actually that you were actually an audio engineer who went to Hollywood and then learned a lot of things along the way. Went to a training course of 6 months to become a programmer and then work hard to become a software developer actually. And then stumbled here and there, ended up in the Netherlands, and then went back to the States again, basically due to love, and doing a job now that I think she really enjoys. And I hope she'll be doing that for like a few more years, and that we'll end up with a great GraphQL client library from Apollo.
When this gets to be where I want it to be, it's going to be really awesome. And I'm really, really excited for that.
Lead Developer, best practices and tips for lead software developers. PDF, MOBI and EPUB format. appforce1.net/lead developer. All one word.